Hello and welcome to our podcast NPP. My name is Chris Köber and I'm an editor at netzpolitik.org.
Und mein Name ist Markus Reuter. Ich rede kurz auf Deutsch. Wir machen den Podcast heute auf Englisch.
Ein zweisprachiger Podcast, aber wir haben einen englischsprachigen Gast, deswegen heute auf Englisch wechsle ich zurück. So, our topic for today, machine learning and artificial intelligence, seems like everybody's talking about it these days and how it will radically alter our work, our love life and our everyday in general. This is not a futuristic scenario, it's something that is already happening today and in many ways our actions and options are already controlled by algorithms. One sector where this can be seen in quite a dramatic way is the food delivery business. A few years ago, riders with a characteristic styrofoam boxes on their backs appeared all over the city. The two main competitors until recently were Deliveroo, wearing turquoise. It's a British company. And the other one was Foodora in pink until recently, because recently Foodora, that was a part of Rocket Internet, was sold for almost €1 billion to a competitor from the Netherlands. So now all its riders work for Lieferando and wear orange. What hasn't changed, though, is the way that these riders work. They are coordinated by an app that tells them where to pick up and deliver their next meal. And in the background, this coordination is done by an algorithm routing and controlling the riders, and in the process also controlling quite a big part of their lives. How this works exactly and how it affects the riders, that will be our topic for today. And our guest, an expert on the topic, is Joanna Brunowicka. She's a sociologist at the European University Viadrina, researching how technology affects work. Hello, Joanna.
Hello.
Hello.
Did we pronounce your name right? I just realized. Can you please say it?
Joanna Brunowicka.
Joanna Brunowicka. All right. You have completed a study about digital control in the food delivery sector in Berlin called The App as a Boss, Control and Autonomy in Application-Based Management. And actually, this phrase, be your own boss or control your own hours, is a claim that these companies use quite a lot to attract potential riders working for them. How much autonomy would you say does someone delivering food for one of these companies actually have?
We have studied this topic for about 2 years in an interdisciplinary team by colleague Mirela Ivanova. She talked mainly to the Lieferando, to the Deliveroo and Foodora riders here in Berlin. We also have a professor of law, Eva Kocher, and expert in technology, Ben Wagner, in the university in Vienna. And what we were curious to study is to what extent this promise of freedom, autonomy, flexibility, all these words that very much resonate with young people nowadays, to what extent that promise is true, because these companies use this promise in how they recruit people, and actually it's quite easy to get a job at one of these two companies, which means the threshold is very, very low. You don't have to speak German. Which means that the crowd is very international. It's quite young. Majority are men, but there are also some women. It's a really diverse group of people, quite well-educated, actually, too. But what they have in common is that they initially think that this work is going to give them flexibility in terms of working hours. So some of them are students, some of them have it as a second job. So they think, okay, I will be able to decide when I work. I will be able to decide where I work, maybe in a neighborhood of Berlin that I know best. And I will have fun. I will be riding a bike and there is no boss. You know, we're talking about, for many people, it's their first job. So they just want something like, you know, exhilarating. For other people, it might be a break from other working experiences where they had boss or colleagues that were, you know, bothering them. And now they're finally happy not to have a boss. So that's kind of the promise. But then what we discovered in our research that the reality is very different. And of course, over with time, they slowly discover what the rules of the game really are.
Rules of the game, that's a good question. But maybe first tell us, you interviewed writers here in Berlin, right? Mm-hmm. In what time frame did that happen and how many people did you speak to?
So the interviews happened mainly last year, in 2018, over, I would say, a six-month time frame. And we talked to about 20-something people from both companies. So at the time, it was Deliverr and Foodora. And we really wanted to study these two companies, because they actually have a very different employment model. So people at Deliveroo are self-employed contractors, whereas people at Foodora are employees. They have mini job contracts, so that's in Germany about 450 euros per month or sometimes more. But they get minimum hourly wage, whereas the Deliveroo riders are paid per order. And we wanted to see the differences between these two employment setups. What they do have in common is that they work for an app. And the apps are slightly different, but as we discovered, the mechanisms that are embedded and the way that the app affects their working life is very similar. So in both cases, the riders receive the orders via the app. What is different is that delivery riders, because they're self-employed, they have the right to reject any order that they want. The Foodora riders, because they're employees and they are expected to work in a specific time frame, they have to take every order. That was the main difference. But the working process, the steps along the way are very similar, which means that so they get an order and they accept the order, they swipe, and they actually swipe many, many times throughout one order. So there are these micro tasks, micro steps where they have to click in the app. So I picked up an order I arrived at the restaurant, I picked up an order, I arrived at the customer, I delivered. And as they're working, also the app is tracking their GPS location. So when you think about that, for each order you have the GPS trajectory in the city and these clicks generated by the riders, that's a lot of data that the company can work with.
And I mean, unlike a dispatch center that would control maybe taxi cab drivers, there isn't an actual center where people are sitting and distributing the different food orders to different riders, right? So it's all done by algorithmic control. How is this working? Like, how does this, I think you called it the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the rules of the game? How is this algorithm set up?
Perhaps we should go one step back. The business model of this platform is, how is it with the restaurant? Like, how does this work? So there's Foodora, and then you have a restaurant, and the restaurant, they just put their menu inside, and then
So you as a customer just get on the platform and you see all these restaurants, and these are the restaurants that sign a contract with one of the companies, and they have to share part of the profit with them. Oftentimes, this really changes the way the restaurant works and how it gets some of the profit. And of course, with Deliveroo and Foodora, it very much depends on the weather or on the mood of the customers, because maybe there is a football game or something. We didn't study so much the impact on the restaurants, but it does have definitely impact also on the gastronomy in the city. How it works for the company, well, it gets part of the profit from each order, and shares, of course, part of that with the riders, but keeps a large part to themselves. The algorithm that distributes the orders to the customers and to the riders It's probably the most important piece of intellectual property in each one of these companies. So the companies use this data about patterns of how people move around the city, about even weather patterns or exactly whether there's a football game, what affects how and where and when people order food. And they have an algorithm that distributes. How this algorithm works, we don't know. The companies sometimes, for example, Deliveroo even named this algorithm.
What so is it called?
Frank. So there it goes to make your algorithm more friendly. So we know that Frank exists, and we know that Deliveroo is very proud and hired a lot of engineers and machine learning specialists to optimize Frank. But actually, who optimizes Frank are these riders that provide a lot of data that feeds. The riders don't know how the orders are distributed. Of course, they try to reverse engineer in their heads how it works. What it means is they have a lot of, I would say, imaginations or guesses about how the algorithm works. Some you can call them maybe also myths sometimes. We don't know, right? Because to a certain extent, maybe collecting data by the riders about how the algorithm works and sharing it with other people can actually lead to some interesting conclusions. But there is no way of verifying that information. So so the riders are not only in terms of how the algorithm distributing orders, but in terms of every single aspect of their work. They're forced into a guessing game.
So basically, it's even though there's this promise of you're your own boss, you don't, in the case of Deliveroo, you're self-employed, you don't have to take any rights that you don't want to. There's a really strong imbalance of information going on that basically
oh,
they
yes,
don't know
that's
how
just the
it
beginning
works.
Of it. This is just the beginning that you don't know the rules of the game. And think about, you know, starting a new job and not having a supervisor and not having any colleagues or any onboarding process or proper onboarding process.
How does the onboarding work? Is it like...
There used to be a little bit more elaborate onboarding where there were, you know, like senior riders that people that wrote that kind of you would ride with them and they would explain you a little bit. This is constantly changing. So one of the things about this research is that I'm telling you a lot about what the situation was like last year. But already last year, we realized that the company has deliberately cut on a lot of things that were helping riders to get information about how the rules work and also share information. So, for example, there used to be meeting points in the city that were designated by the company. There used to be inside the working app, kind of like a HipChat app for them to communicate in the horizontal.
They cut it.
And they started cutting it. There used to even be after work beers. And that suddenly, you know, started disappearing. It's really difficult to trace in time how, but it seems like there's always every time that there's a new round of employee, there's less and less of that. So the riders are really in this information vacuum. And how do they respond? So they start playing this guessing game. I mean, it's not very different from when you actually play a game where you don't know the rules of the game, right? And you're trying to figure out by trial and error how things work. And then maybe, like in games, you would have like a forum where you share information about what you discovered. Here, they set up these WhatsApp groups by for example, area of the city, and they start exchanging information.
But this is like an underground kind of situation, yes, where when they meet, they exchange numbers. This doesn't happen through official
Fedora. No, this is the first step. The first way they can react to the fact that the company really does not provide, the companies don't provide sufficient information, and that's the first natural reaction, that they talk in person, of course, when they see each other, and then they exchange phone numbers and set up this parallel communication structures. And they try to figure out the rules of the game together, but of course, in a real game, there's kind of like ability to progress and see if you have unlocked the next level. Here, another thing is that, you know, you will never get a straight answer from any of these companies about how things work. Usually they don't answer at all or after a couple months. So there's, you know, they try to limit communications between the writers, but also with the company.
I've read these interviews with writers who claim to have found out certain consequences. For instance, one said that he deliberately started writing slower because he realized that the slower he writes, and there isn't a time frame, so they're not pushed to actually deliver the food fast. And he realized that if he writes slower, he gets easier, shorter routes, whereas when he was riding his bike a lot faster, he would actually get really long deliveries. So in order to ease his own life, he started, he said he became Berlin's friendliest bike rider or something like that, waiting at every intersection.
That would
be an example, but one actually confirms that this is how the algorithm works, and it might have changed since then.
It might have changed. That's right. The writers develop a lot of theories about whether the algorithm is fair. For example, some believe that it might try to distribute the number of orders evenly throughout the day, so everybody, you know, makes the same amount of money, or in case of delivery riders, waiting is really bad because you lose money by waiting because you paid per order. So they try to, you know, shorten the wait. The algorithm tries to shorten the waiting time. So they try to develop these theories, but yes, we don't know to what extent they're true, and they're definitely constantly changing. But what is actually the biggest problem is the way that the app embeds the mechanism of control of the company. And this is also something that takes a while for the writers to figure out. But the app, as you said, the app doesn't control how fast you ride. There's actually no speed recommendations or limits or anything like that.
But it knows how fast.
But they're not interested. The company is not interested. You are interested as a delivery rider to deliver as fast as you can
because you want to make more cash.
You want to make a next order, so it's only in your interest. And actually, the company.
But Foodora, you're paid. You're not paid by ride.
Yeah. So to a certain extent, Foodora is more interested in speed, whereas Deliveroo is more interested in you actually showing up for shifts that you signed up, so attendance. So they have, because of the different employment models, they have a slightly different thing that they control. But for example, neither of the companies controls the path that you take. So in that case, you have autonomy, and you know, neither company controls how fast you ride. So if you want to ride fast, you can. And actually, some of the riders even install like an extra app called Strava to see how fast or how many kilometers. So things that the app doesn't measure, but the app does measure a lot of things, a lot. And these statistics are only partially known to the riders. So the company reveals certain information to the riders in weekly reports how well they did. You're in the top 5%, or you're in the bottom 50%. Try harder next week, you know. And to a certain extent, sometimes we were able to figure out some of the statistics that are used. And as I said, in case of Deliveroo, it's definitely showing up for a shift on time and not canceling shift in less than 24 hours.
But are there any repressions? Like if you do cancel a lot, or if you do end up in the bottom 30%, what happens?
Of course. And this is as I said, it takes a little bit to figure out, but the consequences are very serious. So in both cases, the company uses these statistics, the companies, to automatically compile, you know, these profiles of a rider. And then based on the statistics, that, as I said, we don't know always exactly what they're measuring. And even if we know what they're measuring, we don't know exactly how. And there are a lot of mistakes. But based on the these statistics, the writers are automatically sorted into three categories. And then only the writers in the top category with the best performance statistics can get the best shifts. So, like, let's say Deliveroo opens their planning of shifts for next week on Monday, and at 11 you can book if you're in the best performer. Then if you're middle category, maybe at 1, and then if you're the worst performer, only in the afternoon when everybody has already picked the shifts they want.
So basically, if you don't want to end up in a residential neighborhood at Monday morning doing a shift, then you're really interested in performing better.
Exactly. So you're really stuck with the worst shifts, which mean, in case of Deliveroo, much less money. In case of Fedora, you know, also less orders, so less tips. So you have a huge interest in staying in the top category. And the consequences of being in the lowest group are really bad, because, you know, you kind of fall into this vicious cycle that
so you don't come out of this bad group because you've...
It's actually not clear how to improve your statistics.
Because always. You don't know.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, again, people try to guess but we don't know, for example, how big these categories are.
So they don't. So you get a report telling you how you did, but it doesn't say based on what data you did well or not well.
To a certain extent, they share some of the data to allow you to improve. To a certain extent, it's unclear. It's, for example, unclear how big is the biggest category. I don't know, for example, right. Some writers said that when they were hiring a lot of people for last summer during the World Cup, they actually made the biggest category, the first category, big, because mm-hmm. they wanted everybody to, you know, feel mm-hmm. great that they're working a lot. So but we don't know exactly how big are the categories, how big, how many people are per shift, how many, used to be not clear how big the zones of the city are. A lot of the things that would really help you make rational decisions are not known to you. And as I said, the consequences of being in the lowest category is, in case of Deliveroo, you know, you're making less money, so you're less motivated to work. And then maybe the company doesn't have to deactivate you, but you will just stop working yourself. So you quit yourself. This is, you know, a filtering mechanism where you're basically discouraged. In case of Fedora, well, first of all, Fedora and now Lieferando, they hire people mainly for trial period, Probezeit in German, so 6 months. And after 6 months, you can be terminated, and you are working with the hope of your contract being prolonged. But at least, as we talked to Lieferando writers last month, not many people are hoping now that their contracts will be prolonged. But of course, they don't know that when they sign up, right? But Fedora or Lieferando can easily use the statistics also to dismiss the lowest performers and only keep the best performers. So you don't know exactly what the consequences are. And this starts being a source of stress and anxiety among at least some of the writers. And of course, the self-surveillance and trying to perform better, but not really knowing what the rules of the game are. But because the main thing that was the prize, the autonomy, the flexibility of knowing exactly when and where you will work, is taken away from you. And suddenly you have to compete with the other writers for this flexibility.
I think it's really interesting how, from what you explained right now, it really sounds like these companies have set up and optimized basically the whole system of algorithmic control and just the whole way the system is set up for their own interests. So getting, for instance, have planability, have writers reliably show up for their shifts, and probably other goals, but they're obviously optimizing for their goals. So now the question that occurred to me is, like, how are, what kind of organizing? So maybe let's go to the topic of organizing, because you also were looking at ways that these writers are trying to organize outside of traditional, you know, unions, kind of, or in other ways. How does this organizing work, and do the writers demand to have a say in how the algorithmic control over their work is being set up? Because it sounds like that would be probably one important claim.
I also wonder if it's, because if you're like employed somewhere, you have the right to see what data has your employer. Because if you have like the Personalakte in Germany, you know, then you are allowed to see it and see what is in it. Did people ask for give me my data, or just have it like a?
So just as a way of introducing you to what kind of resistance we had in Berlin, and in April 2017, the riders started organizing within this union. It's an anarcho-syndicalist union called FAU, and they started a campaign called Deliver Union, which is very interesting because it crosses the boundaries between these two companies. And both the Fedora and Deliver riders, I mean, they have their own groups because some of the problems are separate, but they decided from the very beginning to work together. And I think they managed to raise awareness of many customers in Berlin about working conditions and bring the topic kind of to the public discussion. So in that sense, they were successful. They were also very successful in building a transnational movement. So in Berlin, we have these two companies, but we also have Uber Eats and other cities in Europe, and the riders from all over Europe, you know, they're always usually organized in exactly some kind of alternative unions, like FAU, smaller autonomous unions, or sometimes traditional unions get involved. Last year in October in Brussels, there was a meeting of about 30 different organizations of riders across Europe. And this is very helpful because sometimes the companies do a lot of, as I said, they change the rules all the time. But sometimes they will test some rules in one place and then import them to Berlin. And then you can use that knowledge of the rider somewhere else to see how the conditions
have changed. To give them a
heads
up, kind of.
So there has been some formal, very visible public organizing, and it's been very important. But as researchers, we're also very interested in the forms of resistance that are not so visible to the public, so more hidden from the public eye and yet still collective. So when I was talking earlier about the riders kind of guessing the algorithm or setting up these parallel communication structures, that's the kind of the foundation, that's the first step of resistance, right? And you can say that some researchers say that gaming is not resistance, because you are just trying to game the system for your personal advantage. But we argue with my colleague Mirela Ivanova that if this knowledge becomes collective, if you share the knowledge about how the algorithm works and how you game it, then it is resistance, because you are kind of uncovering the dynamics of power, the parameters that are used to control you. So when riders share information about how to maybe hide their location on GPS, and when they start exchanging shifts, we found out this very interesting practice that people that had good statistics and had access to the best shifts would use somehow the system to share it with people that were in the worst.
They changed their smartphones, or what did they do?
I can't reveal so much they did that, because exactly that's sort of, this knowledge that is shared, but...
So there's elements of solidarity that are actually trying to work around the total surveillance.
There's definitely a lot of solidarity that would go far beyond what we see when we look at these wonderful campaigns like Delivery Union. So I think that's a very interesting new topic of research, these more hidden forms of resistance that are related specifically to this algorithmic management, where the company holds all the information and creates an information asymmetry where the riders don't have any access to their own data or to the data like the algorithm of the company distributing the orders, whereas the company has all the data. So this information asymmetry is the foundation of the power asymmetry. I mean, there's always a power asymmetry between an employer and employee, but here it's made worse by the information asymmetry. And of course, this guessing and gaming techniques that we discovered are all aimed at evening it out. That being said, I mean, still very much, as I said, the movement in Berlin at least is about 2 years old. So from the perspective of writers, it's a very long time. From perspective of new types of work and new types of resistance, it's very short. But we could say that most of the demands that the writers formulate are not related to technology. I mean, technology is everything they talk about when, like, the exchange information. But when it comes to formulating demands as a union or directly to the employers, of course, wages are very much important. Yeah. Or accident insurance. Or even money for bike repairs. Because, of course, if you're... in case of Deliveroo and Foodora, you are using your own bikes, you are using your own smartphones, so when that breaks, it can be a very big expense. So these were the initial demands. We are noticing as I said, the interest in technology is there, but I think the ability to formulate demands is developing as the awareness grows. Because as I said, for every new batch of writers, it takes away a while to develop this awareness of how technology controls them. We haven't seen any direct demands to the company for access to your own individual data or how the algorithm works. There is a case in the UK, in London, of Uber drivers demanding the access to their data to so they use this kind of famous digital rights lawyer who helped them to formulate this case under the new GDPR rules. So that would be a precedent, because at least
I thought about this rules, because there you are allowed to say, hey, what data do you have of me?
And not only you're not only entitled to know what data is gathered about you, but actually GDPR is also protecting workers in Europe to have their data just gathered. So how is it even possible that these companies can gather this copious amount of data that you just mentioned by, you know, all the inputs in the app, the GPS tracking, under GDPR laws in Europe?
The General Data Protection Regulation, which entered into force last year, it's a big step forward in terms of harmonizing rules of data protection, data processing across different countries in the European Union, and different countries start from different levels. Different countries in Europe also have very diverse labor laws. But it is not specifically designed to cover employee situation. It does have an Article 88, which is specifically about data of employees. But actually, as a result of negotiations, this was very much left to the competence of national, nations, member states, so national laws. There are some things that are still protecting the riders that are the general rules, like consent, or the riders should be informed about certain forms of data processing and using automated profiling without any human intervention is prohibited under the GDPR. And as I mentioned, as a user of technology, you should have a right to your data, to see it, to change it. But these rules are still very new. As I said, it's a big step forward, but a lot of things are still left in the competence of national laws, especially labor national, for example, in Germany, labor laws, collective agreements, also in case where unions are present. But also in Germany, for example, case law, court rulings are very important. So it would be interesting to see how the law will also evolve, as there will be new rulings that are related specifically to this very technology-heavy workplaces.
How did the companies react to all this organizing? You spoke about 30 unions all over Europe. And how did they react in Berlin?
There is only one reaction, and it's silence.
Ah, they didn't react.
Complete silence. So there was a moment, I think it was last year, when the writers from Deliveroo managed to collect 150 signatures, and they delivered it to the company in a pizza box. And there were demands, specific demands that they had, and they never got any reply from the company. The company did send an email to everybody saying, oh, you might have heard about this third party trying to represent you. It's not a third party, it's 150. So a big share of the riders that were saying, but they were trying to, you know, create this fictitious third group. But actually, their strategy is quite effective. The strategy of not communicating.
So if you don't communicate, you don't accept the other side as somebody to
and it is very discouraging to the writers not to have any
kind of like talking to a wall.
Yeah, any channels of communications. And of course, this is very unfortunate because it's an opportunity missed for the companies. As you mentioned, the companies are probably mostly interested in profit and optimizing for their customers. But it's an opportunity missed to make the whole product also better. You know, you could think of the fact that the whole technology could be designed in a way that it serves both the interest of the company and the needs of the worker. This worker-centered approach to design could be beneficial for both sides, you know? Mm. Sharing the data could help the riders make better decisions. So I think that you know, there in technology development, there's this new standard right now to really pay attention to user needs, this user experience and designing around making sure that the user has the best experience. This is, of course, in this philosophy is present in these companies, but the only users that they care about are the customers, and they have UX departments, but these departments do not care about the workers' experience. But the same methods that are used to make the technology friendly for us could be used to make the technology friendly for the workers.
I mean, in theory, yes. But if you look at it, I mean, if I'm just going to be like devil advocate, like slip into the mind frame of how management at these companies might think, I mean, if labor is really cheap and really easy to get in the sector, as you described, because usually employers have a rational motivation to keep on workers because it costs a lot to find new qualified people, to train new qualified people. So a lot of big companies are really, you know, have the horror that someone they just hired is going to leave half a year later, and they make an effort to keep people happy. But it sounds like here, basically, it's such an in and out, you know, it's like 10 people are leaving, 20 new potential riders are around the corner. And also it started from what you said about how the onboarding works and how they enter the work process. It's basically...
Here's the app.
Yeah, I mean, do these companies have an actual advantage from more experienced riders, or does it really not make that much of a difference for them?
You are absolutely right. The turnover, and especially in big cities like Berlin, where there's always new people arriving, is so big that it really means that there's not much incentive to keep the riders happy. That's right. But at the same time, these companies are competing between each other, and they're competing for capital. They are kind of riding on free money from venture capitalists at the moment, and that money can be over at any point, and you never know if you know what's going to be the competitive advantage. Maybe being worker friendly is going to be the advantage of one company over the other, and especially not falling into troubles with the law. But also customers. I mean, I don't think it's a good way forward for customers to boycott any of these companies, because they are important employers that provide opportunity to people that maybe wouldn't have other interesting opportunities otherwise. But the customer might start paying attention to which one of these companies is treating their workers better. So I think, yes, you're right that they don't have much interest in that. But just like with GDPR, which kind of showed the way forward, that there are certain regulations that can be good for privacy of the customers and help to run companies better and make certain European products more competitive in the global market where they are, you know, branded as privacy friendly. In the same way, some of these companies could get a head start. At least that's what I believe. Even as an experiment, it would be interesting to use some of the methods that are used by user experience design, you know, quantitative and qualitative research, where you just ask the writers about certain feature, you discover bugs, you fix the bugs. But you also have interviews with the writers or focus groups where you can figure certain things out, that you use the knowledge of the writers not only to make the working conditions better, but just to make the product better. That opportunity, that potential is not used.
You mentioned the customers. Actually, think that's great, because it was one of the questions that we also wanted to ask. And you said that basically boycotting is not, I mean, hello, customers, if you're out there, are you listening? Okay, this is, so the question is, what can and should customers do in solidarity with the writers to improve the situation?
I heard that question asked many times to the writers directly. And they usually say, do not boycott these services. Just tip us. Just give us a tip. You know, the wages are low enough. The cost of living in Berlin is rising. So if you can spare an extra euro or two, just tip, especially if it's a big order or there's no elevators, you know. But also just pay attention.
Just start doing, like, implementing 50% tipping on your order. Up to 50%. Up from 50%. Whatever, it could also be like 100, 150-ish.
Whatever you can do. I mean, I think the most important thing is that we keep paying attention. And I think these movements have been quite successful in mobilizing public attention, but we should not be fixated about these companies or these particular business models, because these companies, these specific companies, might go bankrupt or be sold off. But the mechanisms that they're implementing will forever change the way we work, and they might be used in completely different professions.
You are also studying call centers. So I was wondering, I mean, you didn't study other examples of gig economy, right? But could you still give a prognosis or tell us what other parts, what other sectors and what other jobs you think that this model could be exported to or soon be also be a problem in? Because I always think it's interesting, like when I think about this kind of algorithmic control, usually it's associated with low-paying, quite precarious jobs, like riding for a food delivery service or working in an Amazon warehouse. And then if you don't fulfill your quota, you're just going to be automatically kicked out, basically. But could it also be something that might also be affecting lawyers or doctors or teachers or even managers, the jobs that we maybe think of as not as precarious and requiring a higher education.
So definitely it is easiest to observe the mechanism of technological control or digital control, algorithmic control specifically, in what you call precarious jobs. I would argue that the conditions, for example, of embedding the control into the app is adding this layer of digital to precarious, right? It's making the precarious conditions even worse, both in terms of the quality of work, but also in quality in terms of the anxiety about what's actually going to happen to you soon. So, as you mentioned, in Amazon warehouses, that's pretty a famous case study. With every time the norms that you have to, the statistics that you have to meet are higher and higher, and it's always easy as to just filter out automatically the lowest performance in a very similar way. And another case study that we studied were call centers or contact centers in Poland and Germany. There was a study that we conducted with a university in Warsaw and Panopticon Foundation in Poland, because the call center sector has been, kind of epiphany of surveillance always. I mean, the phone calls were recorded and monitored. Then this is kind of also something you know when you go into this job, that this is, the control is part of the job. What is different is that it's also kind of, like a testing ground for a lot of newer technologies. So logging the keys on the computer, and also, now there's voice recognition software that allows to control emotional, the mood of the customer or the emotions that you're using or how often you say thank you. So in general, this sector has been, a great testing ground for a lot of surveillance technologies. But as I said, also at the same time, in this sector, a very big sector also in many places, especially in Eastern Europe, where surveillance is pushed to a new level, the people that work there, the young people, they consider it kind of normal or the new normal. So there's actually paradoxically less resistance, because there's never this expectation of autonomy when you go there, and you kind of always know that this is going to be a temporary job that's not fun. And still the main focus of many of the many people just know that they were going to leave, but the focus of the actors that are fighting for better conditions is fighting for better wages and better, there's better contracts, not so precarious contract.
The control is just accepted as basically a given that they don't even think it's worth fighting.
Well, there is now the link becoming apparent between certain things, for example, like the fact that you cannot go on a bathroom break because it's monitored and it becomes part of your statistics how often you went on the break. So there's a lot, very strong quantitative control, and then there's also the qualitative control is increasing because now they're maybe monitoring your emotions and how so people are complaining about that, about the working conditions, but of course technological control is what enables. So I think this is probably slowly gonna grow in prominence as a demand or as a concern, but this is a very difficult sector to organize because of the high turnover, because it's low paid wage jobs for young people that know they're not going to stay there for long, even though oftentimes they do get stuck. So I think that that, as you mentioned, in these precarious jobs, the digital control is particularly scary and very easy to observe. But as I mentioned, the working is changing and is being influenced. And not only the way we're working, but the way we're living is becoming more and more quantified. And we're measuring everything. We're measuring our fitness with the Fitbit. And actually, some of the companies are now introducing some kind of fitness wearable devices as part of their fitness program, but this data is collected by the company and can become problematic for the company to have access to this data or
fertility issues, for instance.
So these are challenges that are already, I think, a little bit better researched in the US, where rules around privacy are more relaxed. In Europe, thanks to GDPR, I think it's going to be much more difficult. So that's one thing. Quantification of life, quantification of work. This is something that that is going to be hard to avoid. And the other thing is qualitative control through ratings. So we already see, for example, that doctors are affected by ratings. You know, when we search on platforms, we see that the reviews of the patients are playing a bigger role in how we pick our doctors. That could also affect other sectors. I mean, maybe we would have university teachers being rated online, and then students would make decisions which class to go to based on that. So that could also affect the way we work, and the private sector particularly is toying a lot with this idea of people analytics, where they have a software on your computer that measures how much time you spend writing emails, how much time you're communicating to other people. Then they do network analysis of who are the people you talk to most. It's not still not very well researched how common that is and how many companies are actually using this or how they're using this. But this is a talk of the game in the human resources sectors. That's kind of where some of the sector wants to move forward, to have this better picture of how committed and connected their employees are. So yes, it's definitely every time that we see an automated decision-making system, we should think about how it's not tied to that one workplace, but how it could spread to other workplaces, or how it could be used by public authorities like a job center or the police. You know, this whenever you have something that is quantified and automated, there is a potential for social sorting and bias and unfairness. So we should definitely be very vigilant.
So the more data we have gathered about us, the more we will be facing consequences of this data being analyzed and maybe algorithmic control in different parts of life. Yeah. It's getting very hot in here, so
I'm waving the door at the moment, so
thanks.
To describe it to our
listeners. Bring a little bit of air. So maybe before we let you go, we were also wondering, you're not just a researcher, a sociologist, but you were also a candidate for the European Parliament in the last elections for DiEM25. Why? What prompted you to want to go into politics?
Well, I was always very interested in kind of the intersection between research as a way of collecting evidence, what's actually happening there. I'm passionate about verifying some of the assumptions that we have. And policies, public policies. I used to work for Ministry of Digital Affairs before coming to Germany in Poland. And politics, because ultimately through public policy we can affect politicians that are out there. Or maybe as members of this generation that sort of was exposed to different technological problems, different, and you know, also work conditions, maybe we could help to design some of the changes for the future by actually running in elections. So I'm actually a member of this Polish left-wing party, Razem, and I run already in Polish national elections 4 years ago. And this year for the European Parliament, I was running as a Polish candidate on a German list for a member of the European Parliament. I was always very interested in this intersection between digital rights labor rights and also migrant rights, because I think that, you know, migration and digitizations are the things that are changing the labor market, and there's a lot of questions about what to do to protect people and to make sure that their rights are protected, as the ways of exploiting our labor, our work, and our data are getting more and more sophisticated. So that's my mission, and I really, you know, believe in this. I really believe in our generation kind of being the pivot in the technological change. And I really believe in transnational politics, which is what DiEM25, Democracy in Europe 25, is about, that we really need to build these connections across different groups of people in different countries, but different communities, like digital rights community and labor rights community, to really use that potential to move European Union forward.
Yeah. So do you see yourself running again? Didn't work out this time, but...
Well, I know that there are elections coming up in Poland in fall of this year. So I think we will have a big chance for the left wing in Poland to play an important role in bringing forward, you know, things like women's rights and LGBT rights, but also changing kind of the narrative about labor rights and digital rights. So I'm very excited about this fall and about campaign in Poland, because we can really make our voices heard. So
if you're listening and if you have a Polish passport, you know who to vote for. Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you
for coming to the podcast. Wir sollten noch die Abmoderation machen.
Auf Deutsch jetzt?
Ja, was? Wie auch immer.
Das war Netzpolitik, der Netzpolitik-Podcast. Die Folge 181 wahrscheinlich. Und ihr könnt uns natürlich wie immer auf den verschiedenen Plattformen, schauen wir schon mit der Plattform, könnt ihr uns hochvoten, damit wir hier irgendwie im Algorithmus besser sind. Ich möchte die Abmoderation nicht machen. Cut, bitte.
Du warst so gut unterwegs.
Ja,
ja, ja, ja.
Wo muss ich wieder anfangen? Genau, ihr könnt uns viele Sterne geben in den Plattformen, damit wir der Algorithmus auch Netzpolitik.org und den Podcast gut benotet und wir dann Vorteile davon haben. Und wir möchten halt auch diesen Algorithmus gamen, natürlich die ganze Zeit. Wir freuen uns über Spenden natürlich, wir sind spendenbasiert schaut auch auf der Seite vorbei und kommentiert. Genau, das ist eine Sache bei den Podcasts, dass wir uns viel mehr Feedback von euch wünschen. Ihr hört uns, das sehen wir in den Statistiken. Aber wir wissen nichts über euch, genau.
Und welche E-Mail-Adresse?
Einfach unter die Folge kommentieren. Ihr müsst dann von dem Smartphone weg und dann da irgendwie aus der App raus und rein. Das ist halt ein Medienbruch, aber macht es mal. Wir freuen uns über Feedback. Und bis zum nächsten Mal.
Wenn ihr den Medienbruch vermeiden wollt, könnt ihr auch direkt
im Browser
mir,
Chris, das anhören,
oder Markus eine E-Mail schreiben. Wir freuen uns auf jeden Fall auf Feedback und wir freuen uns, wenn ihr uns unterstützt und wir noch viele weitere Folgen für euch machen können. Vielen Dank. Tschüss.